I changed the title a little bit. First, I wanted to talk about only a dream regulatory network, and now I extended it because I would like to try to talk about the model of a single transaction network as well. And to give you a broad perspective, my research is philosophically very similar to the last two talks in yesterday afternoon. I am trying to attain a functional understanding of cellular systems by dynamic modeling of these systems. Okay. So my research focuses on and around the cellular level. So some of the work I'm doing is intracellular, and some of them is cell-to-cell interaction. So if you think of cells, they are definitely complex systems in several different ways. They are composed of different elements. They have mRNA, DNA, proteins, small molecules, large molecules. These elements interact in very diverse and nonlinear ways, and they form these interactions for networks. And usually we think about signal transduction networks, gene regulatory networks, metabolic networks, protein interaction networks, and we are trying to separate and separately understand them. What separates cells, complex systems, from other complex systems is that they have a function that they need to perform, because otherwise the organism would not survive. So they need to sense the environment, respond to the environment, they need to replicate, they need to differentiate, they need to form collectives, they need to talk to each other in tissues, and so on. So if you think about cells as systems, these systems need certain dynamical features. They need to be sensitive to some changes, insensitive, or adaptable to other changes. They need to be robust to unwanted perturbations. They need to work in noisy environments. They need to be evolvable, and they are shaped by evolution. So a broad question that one can ask is, in these systems, if there's a network architecture among the interactions, what are the topological or architectural features of these networks that can ensure robust and reliable dynamics? And as a little aside, you've seen in Joel Wheeler's talk, everybody thinks of something else when they think of networks. So my own thinking, when I see a network, I see a process or several processes. And of course, for that to be true, for somebody to think of a process when they see a network and not a hairball, there more information is needed, not just connectivity, who talks to whom. So we need sources, inputs to the network. So places where the environment would act on a network. We need directionality or causality, so we need directed edges, basically. We need outputs or outcomes, so nodes or features of the network that represent two phenotypes, for example. And all of these are necessary, and if they are not present, like they are not present in protein interaction networks, they need to be introduced in some way. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about the definition of different networks that we usually use. So for protein interaction networks, the nodes are proteins, and the edges of the network are protein-protein interactions binding up to proteins. And these are usually undirected. They don't have sources, and the outputs are specified. For signal transduction networks, the nodes can represent very different entities. It can be proteins, molecules, and the edges also represent different types of interactions and reactions. What is common to them that there is an information transfer, an information propagation from the outside of the cell, from the environment, towards the inside. So the signal transduction network connects ligands from the outside to receptors, then protein-protein interactions, reactions, and ends usually in transcriptional regulation or motion. In metabolic networks, the nodes are metabolites and enzymes, so these are two separate types of nodes. And the metabolites participate in the metabolic reactions. They can be educts or products of the reaction. And in this representation, we have a separate node for the reaction itself, and the enzyme is represented as acting on the reaction, catalyzing the reaction. So you can see that the edges also need to be separated into edges representing mass flow or catalysis. In gene regulatory networks, we definitely have transcriptional regulation as the most important component, but we also have translation as a component of it. So we need two types of nodes, the mRNAs and the proteins. The interactions from the mRNA to the protein will be translation, and interactions from the proteins to other or its own mRNA will represent regulation, transcriptional regulation. And it can have one of two sides. It can be activating or inhibiting. So this way we can construct, we can separate and try to tease out the separate types of interaction networks, but they in fact are very intertwined. Because the activity of transcription factors is usually regulated by protein-protein interactions, like the binding of two proteins to form a protein complex, which might work as a transcription factor, or as post-translational modifications of transcription factors. And these post-translational modifications are done by proteins, and these proteins could be acted on through signal transduction networks by external signals. So this way you can see that transcriptional regulation, protein-protein interactions, and signal transactions all work together. So in the last decade, there have been tremendous experimental advances, and now we have genome-level maps of interaction networks. So we have protein interaction networks, interactions among thousands of proteins from yeast, Drosophila, C. elegans, and the human interactome is starting to be mapped. We have metabolic networks available for a variety of organisms. We have transcriptional regulatory networks, specifically the transcription factor gene part of that, for E. coli, yeast, parts of the sea urchin transcription. And we have signal transduction networks. And the largest signal transduction network to date was published last year, and this is the signal transduction network in the mammalian hippocampal neuron. And this was actually obtained not by high-throughput experiments, but by manual curation. So collection of the information from experimental papers. So when we look at these networks just on their topology, we see a lot of shared topological features, weak or connectivity or weak connectivity. So if there are no directions of large connectivity of the network, like the protein interaction networks all have giant connected components in them. The transcriptional and metabolic networks are directed networks. They don't have giant, strongly connected components, but they are nevertheless weakly connected. There's a large heterogeneity in terms of the number of interacting partners, and that is what we represent with the degree distributions. Intuitively, what it means is that there's a large range in the number of reactions a certain metabolite can participate, or in the number of interacting partners of a protein, or in the number of transcription factors that can regulate a gene, or the number of genes that a transcription factor can regulate. So large ranges. And there are also abundant and apparently conserved network motifs, small interaction patterns that we see in every type of network.
Can I ask you kind of elementary yes. question? So to a mathematician, we love it when we're given a network, but I was wondering, how complete do you consider these to be? I mean, as a biologist, for biologists to look at this, mm-hmm. do you say, yes, this is the complete network in the same way of a complete genome, or is it just kind of...
No, they are by no means complete. The coverage is estimated to be around 10%.
10%?
Yes. So we are far from being complete, but and what is interesting is that for the yeast protein interaction network, we have two very little overlapping data sets, but both of them have these topological features. So you could say that the features are already present in these small samples that we actually have. But of course, that can be argued.
So could I
yes.
Say something at this point? So there's different degrees of completeness. So for example, in yeast and many other organisms, the complete gene set is known. So
right.
that's complete. But
the interactions, yes.
The interactions. Are what's in
the other question I have, and I know it's a very difficult one to say something about, is what, you know, if you consider this to be sampling in some way from the network, the 10% that we know, do we understand in any way what the bias of that sampling is, or what, you know, is it somehow random? What is, mm-hmm. you know, what do we know about how the sample of things we do know?
It is probably non-random, and it was suggested that there is a bias towards more known or seemingly more important proteins. So we look at what we think is important. I don't know very much about the statistical aspects of that sampling. It is not my main expertise, but there are definitely biases.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
So from the topology, I actually want to go forward towards the dynamics, because there is an even larger weakness of these topologies in the sense that actually these represent potential interactions that can happen under a certain environment, in a certain cell type, in a certain part of that cell, but they are definitely not happening at the same time in the same conditions in all the compartments of all the cells. So actually only subsets of these interaction networks are active or happening under any given condition. And there are now papers published, one on protein interaction networks and the other in transcriptional networks, in which they show that only subsets of those networks are co-expressed and active at the same time. So for the protein interaction network, what they did is they correlated protein interactions with the expression of the genes encoding those proteins, and they found that highly interacting proteins are separated into two classes. One class, which they called the party hubs, interact with their interacting partners at the same time under the same conditions, so there where all those interactions are present, while the date hubs interact with their partners under completely different conditions, so only very, very small subsets of those possible interactions are happening under the same condition at the same time. And the same with transcriptional networks. Different environmental conditions trigger only a small subset and generally non-overlapping subset of the whole network. So the network topology needs to be complemented by a description of the network dynamics, that is the states of the nodes and how the states of the nodes change in time. And a lot of those states will be zero under certain conditions.
Can I?
Yes.
Another naive question. Well, when you say that sometimes under the same conditions this happens and under the same conditions it doesn't happen, aren't you really saying we don't know what the extra conditions are that trigger those?
Yes, but I didn't say that under the same condition it sometimes happens. So under one condition it happens and under a different condition it doesn't happen. Or it just, the genes or the proteins are not there, they are not expressed under those conditions. So if the nodes are not there, the interaction is also not there. So I am not saying that some nodes sometimes interact and sometimes they don't interact. What I'm saying is they are sometimes not there to interact, not present. So to have a dynamic description, of course, we need a lot more than the topology, and that is unfortunately only available for very small subsystems, which have been experimentally studied for decades. And stories like that are signal transduction by geochemotaxis, Drosophila embryonic segmentation, the yeast cell cycle. So we cannot have dynamic descriptions at the genome level, we need to go to smaller systems. And for the smaller systems, we don't have a complete description from experimental information, but we can use modeling to fill in some of the gaps and make some assumptions to fill in the gaps. So in a dynamic model, we first need to define the system, and that system cannot be a whole cell at this time. And then we need to collect known states or behaviors of the system, like a cell cycle is an oscillation. Or systems during development might have a steady state corresponding to a certain developmental stage. Then the input to the models will be the components, the states of the components. It's our choice how to describe the states. For example, we can use concentrations if we are talking about chemicals, or usually for proteins as well. We describe them by their concentrations, or the number of proteins if the concentration is not the correct way. We know some of the interactions, well, hopefully as much as possible, and then we also need to hypothesize, so the modeler needs to hypothesize other interactions, and usually the kinetics of the interactions are not available, so we need to assume the different rates and parameters. Then starting from an initial condition or from an input, the model will say how the states of the nodes and the state of the system change in time, and that needs to capture known behavior, so the model is validated. And after it is validated, we can explore cases that cannot be studied experimentally. We can change parameters, change assumptions, change initial conditions, and we can give predictions that can be tested. And I think you all know, but there are two different ways of classifying models. We can say that they are continuous, And then these continuous models are usually either chemical kinetics, and for metabolic networks, for example, that's the correct description, or similar, if they are assumed to be similar, if we are not talking about actual reactions. And there are also discrete models, which assume a small set of qualitative states. And then there are deterministic and stochastic models. So the models I will be focusing on are discrete. The first one will be deterministic, and the other will have an aspect of stochasticity in it. And the models will be qualitative. And the reasons for using qualitative modeling is that in many cases, we don't know the functional form of the regulatory relationships. When there are several regulators of a component in the system, we don't know how those regulators add. Are they additive? Are they multiplicative? Are they linear? Are they nonlinear? We don't know. There are no experimental information. So in that case, the simplest that we can do without introducing artifacts is to assume something discrete and qualitative. There is also increasing evidence for robustness to changes in kinetic parameters. So that is also a motivation to try to work without kinetic parameters. So the underlying hypothesis of qualitative models is that the kinetic details of the individual interactions are less important than the organization of the regulatory network. And again, this only works if the organization of the regulatory network is complex enough. Because if the network itself is simple, then by tuning the kinetic parameters, we can find a variety of behaviors. But if the network is complicated and it has certain features like path redundancy or feedback loops, then the existence of those topological features will ultimately simplify the dynamics that is possible. And I think you have seen examples of that in yesterday's talks. So the first step that one can do is a kind of pseudo-dynamic. Start from the sources and imagine a propagation of information in reaction space, basically as a propagation through the edges. And that was actually proposed and done in this paper, which was the paper on the signal transduction network. So we will go a step further than that, but still have a qualitative model which is very much based on the network topology. So the first model I want to show you is a model of the second polarity gene network. So this is a gene regulatory network. The system is biologically defined, and the expression patterns of the genes in this system, so the second polarity genes, are known, and I will show you how they look like. So the input will be the identity and the interactions among the second polarity genes. These interactions are mostly known. And I will briefly touch on a continuous model, a very successful continuous model of this system. And the underlying assumption in the continuous model is that the transcription factors can be assumed to act as enzymes. So we will use something like Michaelis-Menten kinetics, generalization of that. And the Boolean model will assume that mRNAs and proteins activities can be described by switches, basically two states and switching between two states. Both the continuous and the Boolean model reproduces known gene expression patterns. And the continuous model can explore changes in kinetic parameters, and the Boolean model, because it doesn't have that added layer of complexity, it can look at mutations and changes in initial conditions. So it can explore more. And both models agree that the topology is the main source of robustness. So this is how the fruit fly embryo looks like 1 hour after fertilization. It looks homogeneous. There are no differences among the nuclei on the surface of the egg. And 6 hours later, we have the definite pattern of 14 parasegments bordered by parasegment furrows. So the segment polarity genes, specifically two of the segment polarity genes, wingless and ingrained, are the ones which determine where the parasegmental furrows will be, because the cells just anterior to the parasegmental furrows express wingless, and the cells just posterior to them express ingrained. So the furrows will be between the wingless expressing cells and the ingrained expressing cells. And also, a steady pattern of wingless and ingrained is necessary to maintain the parasegmental furrows in this position. The segment polarity genes are part of a cascade, a developmental cascade of gene regulation, and it starts from maternal transcription factor morphogens, which have a gradient starting from the two ends of the egg, and they diffuse, or they are transported, so they have a gradient towards the middle. These are transcription factors, and they activate a set of a set of genes called the gap genes, which will be combinatorially regulated by the morphogens and will be expressed in broad regions. The gap genes are also transcription factors. And they activate the pair rule genes, which will be expressed in seven stripes. And these stripes are regulated individually. It seems that there is no intrinsic periodicity to the initiation of these seven stripes. The pair rule genes are also transcription factors, and they activate the segment polarity genes, which are initiated in 14 stripes, and they maintain these 14 stripes, although the pair rule genes that activated them decay. So all these genes in the initial three steps are transient. They are expressed, transcribed, translated only once, and then they decay, they disappear. But the segment polarity genes maintain this periodic pattern for 3 hours. So biologically, the dynamic state that we want to have is a steady state. And these are the segment polarity genes that we will include. And I just want to say that the proteins are very different. So some of these proteins are secreted proteins like Winglass and Hedgehog. Many of them are transcription factors. Ingrid, Slothy-Pert, and Cubitus activator and Cubitus repressor are transcription factors. And we have two receptor proteins as well. So there is a diversity of the functions of the protein subtypes. So these genes and the gene products interact with each other, regulate each other, and by their interactions maintain basically the same initial condition that they were started from. I'm saying basically because not all of them maintain the exact same pattern. So they've refined the pattern as well. And this is the pattern that we are talking about. This, you can consider this as the initial condition. These are embryo stains, and whenever you see black, that means that those cells express segment polarity genes that the stain was done for. So this row of cells, so-called stripe of cells, expresses in red, and then there is, you can imagine as three stripes that don't express in red, and then the fourth stripe expresses it again. And this is a couple hours later, the embryo changed a lot, but the relative pattern is still the same, one quarter expressed, three quarters not expressed. And Cubitus and Perched are started in broad regions, and the Perched pattern is actually refined, and the Cubitus proteins patterns is also refined. So this is the interaction network the way we have reconstructed it. Every edge here comes from experimental information, but not every edge is direct. The ovals are messenger RNAs, and the rectangles are proteins. So the edges from messenger RNAs to proteins represent translation. And the edges from proteins to messenger RNAs represent transcriptional regulation. So Ingrid is a transcription factor, and it activates Hedgehog, and it represses Cubitus. We also have protein-protein interactions and post-translational modifications. The Cubitus messenger RNA is translated into a cytoplasmic protein, Cubitus protein, which can have one of two post-translational modifications. If one of the two possible is happening, then Cubitus becomes an activator, which activates Winglass and Perched. And that is, the last time I checked, it's not exactly known what kind of modification it is. It could be phosphorylation. This is known, this is a cleavage, so it's the protein is cut into two pieces. And the piece that remains is a repressor, it's a transcriptional repressor, and it represses the same two genes that the activator activates. So the regulation of this switch is very important, and it is done by a signal transduction network that starts from Hedgehog being secreted from the neighboring cell, so this is one cell and this is the other cell. It is thought to be transported, so it's not diffusing, but it is transported. It binds to Perched in the membrane of the neighboring cell, mm-hmm. and it forms the Perched Hedgehog complex. Perched and smoothened are bound together in the membrane, but when Hedgehog binds to Perched, Perched releases smoothened. And smoothened is able to move and to start a cascade which leads to the activation of this post-translational modification and the repression of the other. When there is no free smoothing, then the cleavage will happen and the repressor will be formed. So in this network, we have cell-to-cell interactions through hedgehog and wingless. We have gene regulation, and we have post-translational modification, and we have signal transduction. So let me start with the continuous model. I should say here that the network representation of the continuous model is slightly different, but it doesn't matter that, I mean, it does matter, but it's not as important to describe it here. So the assumptions of the continuous model is that each process, the rate of change of each component can be described by an equation like this. This is only when there is a single activator present, and when there are several activators or repressors, the assumption is that there is still a similar nonlinear form. So the activation part is described by this nonlinear function. And the decay part of each component is assumed to be free, so it is described by a half-life. For the nonlinear part, we have a parameter or combination of parameters describing the maximum activation. We have a constant describing the concentration of regulator corresponding to the half maximum activation, and we have a parameter describing the slope. The larger the slope, the more abrupt this transition is. So
is y known in that equation?
Sorry?
Is y known in that equation?
It's not. Y? Oh yes, so y is the regulator. In this case, it is assumed that there is a single regulator. So this applies for a single regulator, like if you would have a transcription factor regulating transcription. But in reality, in most of these cases in the network, there are several. For example, hedgehog is regulated by an activator and repressed by a repressor. So then you need to come up with a functional form to describe that combinatorial regulation. And this is one possibility for that. So here we have an activator and an inhibitor. So this nonlinear function is used for the activator, and then there is a nested nonlinear function for the repressor. And this is 1 minus the nonlinear form for the repressor. So what happens is when the repressor is saturated, then it completely takes away the activity of the activator. And when it's not saturated, then some activation still remains. So the constants describing the dissociation of, or half maximum response of the inhibitor and the activator determine which one of them is saturated and which one of them is in the low regime or in the high regime or here at the maximum sensitivity range. And that is usually, that kind of assumption is made for every combination. Okay. So one thing that the Fangasa model did was to reduce the two-dimensional pattern into one-dimensional patterns for each of the components. So instead of seeing these stripes on the embryo for ingrid, we see rows of cells, and the periodicity is in here. So the first cell of the pair segment expresses ingrid, and then 3 cells, not expressing, and so on. So these are the experimentally known patterns for the genes and proteins in the system. And this is the Fangasa model's representation. This is the best representation. They assume that the cells are hexagonal. So you can see that there are some differences in their best representation because they don't have a periodicity in the patch pattern, not even in the best solution. But this is nevertheless very similar to what is known experimentally. So there are 16 equations in the Fangasa model for the describing the rate of change of each component and 48 parameters, all of them unknown, and all of them can vary about 3 orders of magnitude. So what they did is they sampled randomly from the parameter space, the 48-dimensional parameter state. They ran the model, and then they looked for a steady state, which then they used, because they have continuous values for all their variables, they used the threshold to decide whether it is on or off, because really the biological steady state is Boolean. A cell is either making that mRNA or protein or is not making. And then they compared with the wild-type pattern, and if they agreed, they accepted it as a solution. So by doing this sampling a lot, they found that 1 in every 46 parameter combinations led to the wild-type pattern. That is to say, 45 parameter combinations did not lead to the wild-type pattern. But what is remarkable is that the solutions were distributed homogeneously in parameter space. you could not restrict any parameter to being small or large. You could have combinations of parameters from every possible region in space that worked. So their conclusion was that it is not the fine-tuning of the parameters that matters. So we wanted to take that further and have model without any parameters, and the Boolean model does not have any parameters. So we formulated a Boolean and logical model. So it is Boolean in the sense that each node has one of two states, on or off, and it is logical in the sense that the rules are described by logical or Boolean rules. So we assumed that transcription depends on the transcription factors. If there's a transcriptional activator, the transcription will happen. If there's a transcriptional inhibitor present, the transcription will not happen. If there are both activators and inhibitors present, the transcription will still not happen, so the inhibitors are dominant. Translation depends on the presence of transcript. So everything will follow the state of their regulators by a certain delay. We also assume that if something is not actively being made or being activated, then it will decay. And the original model made a large assumption, but plausible assumption, that is that the duration of the transcription, translation, decay of the mRNA, or the decay of the protein is on the same time scale. That would be the time scale of several minutes. The protein binding was assumed to be faster than that. So in the original model is a synchronous model. It is assumed that there is a clock in the system and the nodes are changing states according to this clock. Then, in follow-up work with Madalena Chavez and Eduardo Zonta, we relaxed that assumption. So we are not making any timescale assumption anymore. The only assumption that we make is that post-translational processes are faster than pre-translational. Because we don't actually know the durations, what we need to do with these models is to sample them randomly. So in that sense, there is a stochasticity in the model. So now we are assuming that with that single restriction, any process can take any time, short or long.
How do you do the asynchronous update? So the rates for each process are discrete rates?
No, they are not rate. What turns out to be important is the order in which the different nodes are updated. So we have looked at several different mechanisms. And in one case, we had pre-specified durations, times, after which time a certain node is updated. But then we realize that it is not the value of the time that matters, but it's the order, whether something happens earlier than the other process. So what we do is we come up with an order of update, and we update the nodes, and then we change the order of update, and then we update the nodes in the different order. So we randomly randomly sample from every update order. So it is stochastic in that sense. But we have also looked at other variants. And we have also looked at a hybrid model in which there's a combination between continuous and discrete processes. So we try to do it every possible way. Okay. So the regulatory rules are logical rules. So they use the operators and, or, and not. So in the case when there is an activator and there is a repressor, this rule is saying that the repressor needs to be absent in that cell in order for the transcription process to happen and in order for to have the mRNA at any later time. So this is saying that the activator needs to be present in that cell and the repressor needs to be absent. In the synchronous update, this later time is the next time step because everything is updated at the same time at each time step. But in the asynchronous model, this can be any delay. We have encoded the information about each genes into a rule like that. And in the majority of the cases, it was relatively simple to do that because the interactions were already fairly logical. So one interesting thing to point out is that an OR relationship means an independence of the two activators, and an AND relationship means necessary synergy. So we have an initial condition that is experimentally known because we know how these genes are initiated. So Wingless, Ingrid, and Hedgehog are already initiated in the pattern that they will maintain. Cubitus is initiated in a broader pattern. And where you see gray, that means that we assume that in the initial condition, those proteins are not present at all. Each box here represents a cell, and if it's black, it means that that cell is expresses that gene or protein, and if it's gray, it means that it doesn't. So in the synchronous model, if we start from the known initial condition, we will find a steady state which corresponds to the known steady state of the biological system. And this is where the paracegmental furrows will be. And it is also known that the two cubitus proteins have a complementary pattern. So the cell that expresses the activator will not express the repressor. And it is one cell activating the expressing the activator, one expressing the repressor, and one expressing the activator again. So this is a representation of the long-range inhibition, because at the farthest position from Ingrid and Hedgehog, we have the cubitus repressor that represses the same targets that the activator activates. So, yes?
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you mid-sentence, but when you get to a stopping point, could you go back to the previous slide, please, 1 second?
Okay.
So if you look at this actually as a computer language kind of thing, right? You're saying the new value of that variable is on the left, and the right is the new actual data that gets input into that.
Yes.
Right. So you can look at, for example, if you look at WGI, it means you just got the same value as before. Is that what that indicates down there?
This one?
Yeah.
So this is the protein, and that's the mRNA. So what this is saying is that the protein follows the mRNA, because it's made by translation from the mRNA.
So there's some, like, variable position or a property that gets a new value at that point. I mean, that would be the programming language interpretation. Mm-hmm. Is that exactly what you mean, or is this shorthand for something else?
So wingless can have the protein can have a new value, and that new value is determined by the value of the mRNA. It's not determined by its own value, only by its regulator.
Okay.
But this does not refer to the same.
Okay, so my next question is, so you have this particular graph, and each node has a bunch of values associated with these variable names.
Mm-hmm.
Can you abstract away from a certain, set of variable names that have a certain good property and say, if the values are, all of them have this particular set of values, or this particular set of values, or that particular set of values, all of those count as a given desirable property that the whole system has. You know what I'm asking?
Yes, and that seems to be all of them, the state of all of them. You can argue a little bit. Definitely the state of four variables total, but corresponding to two genes, is very important. But arguably, the state of all of these genes are important. So I'm considering that the state of the system is the state of all nodes in the system. That's why I have.
So, but some states are equivalent in terms of being satisfying some larger abstract property, obviously.
I guess so, but all of these were individually measured experimentally. So I don't think, for example, that these two patterns matter at all. But all of these are verifiable experimentally. So when I say that this is the wild-type steady state, I really mean the state of all nodes in the system. And that is what I'm trying to capture. Not a subset of the state, but the state of all nodes. But you could say that this is really only the state of the system that matters, these four variables at the top. And actually, it turns out that in a knockout mutant, so if you would just cut out this whole part of the system, and you start from a correct initial condition, you would be able to maintain this. So that would be, there's a robustness property in the system. But right now we are taking the approach of saying that every state of every node determines the state of the system. That might not be the correct way. And definitely in signal transduction networks, it is not the state of all the nodes, but it's the state of the output node that is important. Okay, so this is, of course, a very simple model, and so the implication that the system correctly captures the state of the real biological system is that the kinetic parameters of the real system don't matter as much as long as an activation is an activation and it's being able to activate its target, and an inhibition is an inhibition. And actually, the inhibitions are also very important to be strong enough. Yes.
I have a question.
every horizontal stripe is for a specific mRNA or a protein. So this is the mRNA, and this is the protein of the wingless gene. This is the mRNA of the Ingrea gene, and this is the protein of the Ingrea gene.
And how can I read that in the real stuff in the real animal?
This, so you can look at going around the borders. So this would be like this. This yellow or orangish thing is the Ingrea. So this would be where Ingrea is expressed, and this is where Ingrea is not expressed. Or for wingless, this is where neither of Ingrea and wingless are expressed, and this is where wingless is expressed. So this is saying that there are three cells where wingless is not expressed, and then it's expressed in the fourth, and then again three, and then expressed in the fourth.
So every stripe is expressed as well?
Yes. And every border is this white column. And there is a periodicity both in the initial condition and in the steady state. And it's a four-cell periodicity. So I can see that I will not be able to tell you about the signal transduction network, so then I can be a little bit more comprehensive with this model. So what you can do with this model, after you have reproduced the wild-type behavior, the wild-type steady state, is to knock out genes. And we can simulate gene knockout by saying that that specific mRNA will be off, and the protein will be also off. And that, of course, can have a lot of consequences, because if that protein was a single activator of another mRNA, then that mRNA will not be expressed, and so on. So the effects of a gene knockout propagate through the system, and our model can easily say what is the end result of that. We always find steady states. And that, I think, is fairly remarkable, because a Boolean model would usually generate oscillations. In this system, we don't find any oscillations. So we find different steady states for different genomes. And here I'm just showing a comparison between what the model says for the pattern of certain genes in certain knockout mutant simulations and what the actual patterns are. So for whenever you see this one-dimensional pattern, think of the two-dimensional pattern. So this is the wild type. This is our representation, and this is how the embryo looks like in the wild type. This is the Ingrea. And this is the cubitus mutant case. Our model says that even when the cubitus mRNA is not present because the gene is knocked out, there should be stripes of Ingrea. And you can see the stripes. They are not exactly the same quality as in the wild type, but they are definitely there. In the patch mutant, our model says that the stripes, or the domain of expression, the cells expressing Ingrea, should broaden. And you can see that they are broadened and more intense. This is for wingless, so this is our representation of the wild type. In the cubitus mutant, the model says that the stripes should be maintained, and they are still present. And in the hedgehog mutant, there should be no stripes. There should be no expression of wingless, and there is no expression of wingless. So whenever there was experimental information about knockouts or knockouts combined by heat shock experiment, our model is always in agreement.
Have you thought about adding more states to get intensity levels?
We don't have a collaborator on this. This is from the literature. I'm just collecting the information.
But I mean in your model.
Adding more states. Oh,
yeah, like high, medium, low.
It didn't seem necessary, but definitely that's a possibility. And actually the mathematics is already fairly well worked out. So instead of Boolean algebra, you use polynomial algebra, and Reinhard Laubenbacher at Virginia Tech is working on that. In this case, we didn't really need it.
Are these results on the synchronous model?
Yes, but okay. So
are
the
talking about that?
We first found them with the synchronous model, but they are actually they are completely independent. They the same result is obtained for the asynchronous model and for the hybrid model as well. So the gene knockouts don't depend on durations, and also don't depend on initial conditions. It doesn't matter what initial condition you start from. If you knock out the gene, the state that you observe is exactly identical.
Do they matter? Do they depend on the order of updates that you mentioned?
No, they don't. They don't. The knockouts don't. Okay. And I should say that the steady states of the synchronous model are the same as the steady states of the asynchronous model. So that's the whole repertoire of the system. What can change in the asynchronous model is there is no deterministic one-to-one correspondence with one state to the next state, because then the order of updates. So you can derail the development. So this is the dynamic repertoire of the system, the steady states that you can find. Four steady states, and three of them are well-known experimentally. Here, I don't mean that the whole state, but different pieces of it are well-known experimentally. So this is the wild-type state that you see in the embryos. This is a broad pattern, which you see in Page knockouts, or also in a lot of heat shock experiments. And what you can see is that the stripes of wingless ending grid are broadened, so more cells express them, and less cells express pivoters. So pieces of it were confirmed experimentally. So we are confident that this is a steady state of the real system. And this is the little pattern in which there is no pattern. So either none of the cells express something, or all of the cells express it. And this is corresponds to a little phenotype in the embryos, which is also known for knockout of wingless ingrid or hedgehog. And our model says that if started from a certain initial condition, the system would be able to maintain this steady state, which is a displaced steady state. It doesn't have a wingless ingrid border, it has an ingrid wingless border, so it would have an ectopic per segment of
program. Excuse me, aren't there more than one displaced steady state?
No, interestingly enough, there aren't. This is the only displaced one. And the reason probably is that we have a protein that is expressed in half of the per segment and not expressed in the other half. So that gives you the region, it restricts the region in which wingless and ingrid can vary. Because, yeah, in principle you could have a number of them, but that source, so it is a source in this network and it restricts the region in which, the region of variability. In the synchronous model, we can also look at what is the minimum initial condition required to find this wild-type steady state. And this is it. Everything that you see in gray means that those can be completely missing. Or you only need two genes in two cells, so PEGD expressed in this cell and wingless expressed in that cell to get to the known wild-type steady state. And these numbers represent the degeneracy of the different patterns that you can have that still lead to the wild type. So you can see that the pattern of these don't matter at all. For some of them, you can have half, and the minimum is three.
Because I can't understand how you can maintain wingless.
Okay, so that that is not. So if we start from the experimentally known initial condition and just vary the pattern of one of them, then three of the possible 16 patterns of wingless coupled with the initial condition of the others could lead to the wild type steady state.
This wingless would be unstable because you don't get hedgehog, which you need to maintain wingless. So that is what you need.
Yeah, you do have, so when you change wingless, you do have hedgehog. So we are not using this as a background. So this is the minimum. If you have this, you will go here, but when reporting these numbers, we are not using this this sparse pattern, but we are using the normal initial condition.
Yeah.
I don't understand. So if a row says 16, that means you can change any position along the row.
So it's the 16. There is always a four cell periodicity. We are not changing that. So in fact, the region is four cells, and then you can have 16 patterns on those four cells.
I see. So you're saying. So you start with the experimental initial condition before, you go into that particular gene,
and
look at all possible combinations on or off, it doesn't matter.
Yes, for these it doesn't matter, yes.
But for the ones where it's three, it does matter.
It does matter, and then you only can have three of the 16. So this only applies to the synchronous model, because in the asynchronous model there is much more variability. So in the asynchronous model, we only started from the wild-type initial condition. And even in that case, if there is a complete variability of the durations, we can go to every possible steady state from the wild-type initial condition. And the incidence of the wild-type steady state was only around 50%. So that's not very good. So that means that if in 50% of the cases the process can be derailed if you use an incorrect order of update or an incorrect duration of times. But if we just use one single very, very plausible assumption, and that is that post-translational processes are faster than pre-translational ones. That's definitely true. The post-translational processes are usually less than a second level, and the pre-translational ones are on the order of minutes. So with that simple assumption, now if we start from the wild-type initial condition, we only find two possible steady states, depending on the orders, the order of updates, or depending on the durations. And in 87% of the cases, we go to the wild-type steady state, and in 12% of the cases, to the broad-type steady state, which is a pattern, it is a periodic pattern, but it's nevertheless not the correct pattern. And in these cases, we can exactly pinpoint what went wrong, and we can exactly say, how can we counteract that? What went wrong is the pattern of the cubitus activator and the repressor. We need that those two proteins are expressed in a complementary pattern. So they are not expressed in the same cell. And we need to have this order of activator, repressor, activator. If that is even transiently imbalanced, then we will find the derailment of the process. So this is a case in which we have transiently expressed either the activator in all three cells or the repressor in all three cells. And this is the example when the repressor is ubiquitous. And then depending on the transient and on the length of the transient, how long that ectopic state is maintained, we have a higher and higher incidence of the non-segmented pattern or the lethal phenotype. So what this predicts is that even a transient imbalance at the post-translational level can have effects as severe as gene knockout. Now the way to counteract that is to initiate the patch protein before the smoothened protein, and that is correct. That is true in the biological system. Yes.
I didn't catch. What do you use as an update rule in your asynchronous model?
So
is it sequential? Or do you do stochastic firing with some?
We use different ways, and one way is to pre-specify the next time when a node will be updated. But it turns out that there's a much simpler way, and that is to just come up with an order of update of the nodes.
So you basically just
sequentially update them. Yes.
So follow-on question.
Yes.
So in some cases, the result depends on the order.
Yes.
In other cases, there might be classes of operations
for
which
exactly.
The order is not important.
Yes, exactly. And the class in which the order is important is the class in which that order results in an imbalance between those two proteins. And actually, that is decided during the first update. If during the first update of the nodes, we find that the activator is ubiquitous and the repressor is not present, then we will go to an incorrect pattern. If we find if the repressor is ubiquitous and the activator is not present, then we will go to an incorrect pattern.
So again, it's a question of the resource being present for it to.
No, it's a question of what is updated first.
But.
And in this, so what is key is these are post-translational modifications, and they are in the same category of update in our case. So if patched is updated before cubitus, then there is a derailment of the process. So that is that there is in fact a fine-tuning of the condition of what it appears first, either by the initial condition, so what is first made, or if that is not true, then by a relationship between the time it takes for something to be made. You really need to both the activator and the repressor to be present in some in a subset of the cells that express the cytoplasmic protein.
So that's the resource I was talking
about. Yes, okay, you can think of it as a resource, yes. Yeah, so that is the only condition in the system. But biologically, it is true that one is really made, it is already present. So maybe in the biological system, this is only a hypothetical scenario, and it never happens because the patch protein is present before the smoothing.
Sorry, I have one more question about the updating. So is it correct that every variable is updated each round?
Yes.
So nothing can be skipped?
Yes.
run, you set an update order and then it's the same each round.
No, 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 we change the update order, yes. Yes, we want to change it because we don't know.
You could randomly randomly permute the order each round.
Yes, exactly. Yes, we randomly permute the order. Okay, so I am almost done. So ultimately, yes, and so we can exactly pinpoint when something goes wrong and we can correct for it. And we also have the hybrid model, and actually the hybrid model does not go wrong. So basically these old generalized models give back the same results as the original synchronous model. So the qualitative model was a correct enough and predictive description of the real system. So the topology does matter very much, and it is determining the dynamics of the system. So looking back at the topology, what exactly was it? Well, we can see a lot, because, for example, we have this chain of activation from Ingrid to Hedgehog. What that means is that Hedgehog will be always expressed in the same cells as Ingrid, and that is true in the biological system. We also have this inhibition from Ingrid to Cubitus. So that means that everything that Cubitus could possibly activate will never be expressed in the same cell as Ingrid. And Cubitus is activating wingless and patched. So that means that wingless and patched will be always expressed in other cells, not in the same cells in Ingrid and Hedgehog. And that is actually biologically true, and it is the reason why these are called segment polarity genes. So the segment is polarized to the Ingrid and Hedgehog expressing cells and the wingless and patched expressing cells. Also, we can see a positive feedback loop from wingless to Ingrid in neighboring cells. So they are inhibiting each other in the same cell, but they are activating each other in neighboring cells. So you can have all these positive feedbacks, and in principle, you could have a very symmetrical pattern of Ingrid, wingless, Ingrid, wingless. But it is sloppy paired, which is the source in our network, and which is expressed in half of the pair segment, that is restricting this expression. So only this, these two parts of it are happening in the real system. So that, oh, I'm sorry, not these, these two. So wingless, or not wingless, sloppy paired is the source of the asymmetry of the pattern. So the network topology does tell us a lot, but we needed the dynamic model to be able to realize it. Okay, so I will skip the signal transaction network and just conclude by saying that the topology of regulatory networks, especially if it is a complex topology, has a major role in determining their dynamical behaviors. And I would say that it is so complex in order to have a robust and simple dynamics. And I would like to propose that it is possible to make predictions based on qualitative models. We are not saying that these are the correct descriptions, but they are correct enough that they can lead to new predictions that can be tested, and they can lead to new biology. So the Drosophila work that I have presented, we started with my postdoctoral mentor, Hans Otmar, and we are now collaborating with Madalena Chavez and Eduardo Zontag on that. Madalena did all the mathematics, and she has actually some beautiful proofs about what can happen in this system. And the work that I have not presented is done with a plant biologist, Sarah Osman, and our co-advised student, Song Lee. Thank you very much.